One of the most common questions that I get, I receive, has to do about the difference between mindfulness practice and concentration practice. And in a very kind of simple, I often give kind of answers. I try to answer it in various kind of logical ways, best I can. And you know, the most simple answer is that mindfulness has to do with a clear knowing of what's going on, and concentration has to do with kind of a clear, pointed or composed focus, absorption in what we're paying attention to. But this question of the difference between concentration and mindfulness is something that the Buddha also had to address. And he often addressed it by using imagery, kind of similes or analogies for these two. And I thought I would share some of these images, the imagery that the Buddha used for these two different practices. And maybe in sharing them to you, maybe try to, I don't know, doing a guided meditation is probably not right, but maybe there's, if you listen to the ideas, the imagery, and take them in, maybe you can get a kind of visceral feel for this. And as we do this, what I'm going to do is actually contrast. You'll see the contrast between mindfulness and concentration. If you look at the teachings of the Buddha around mindfulness and concentration, he has a variety of verbs he uses to describe the action, the activity that you do when you concentrate, the activity you do when you're mindful. And one of the most common words that he uses for mindfulness has a variety of verbs that have the word seeing in it, to see. And for the concentration, he uses often the verb to touch. So seeing and touching. So these are two different practices, two different modes of being, right? You can touch something and know something through touch, and you can see something and know something through your eyes. So they're two different modes of knowing, two different modes of being in the world, seeing and touching. One, in a sense, is more can be understood as being more bodily, and the other maybe a little bit more mental. The Buddha doesn't make a sharp distinction between body and mind, but there's usually concentration practice is associated with the body more. It's actually, you know, it's touching. It's a touching practice. And though many people think of concentration as just a mental thing, one-pointed focus. And mindfulness is more associated with the mind because it has to do with knowing. Concentration practice has more to do with relaxation. Often people associate concentration with relaxation. And they do it to get relaxed. And mindfulness practice has more to do with clarity, developing clarity. So again, there's a contrast. Another contrast is that concentration practices tend to produce experiences of unity or experiences of oneness. Whereas mindfulness practice in its maturity tends to create experience of independence, of freedom. So there's a difference between, you know, unity or oneness and freedom or independence. So that's kind of the background. So here is an image or analogy, simile for concentration practice. Adopted a little bit for our modern life, slightly. So I'm going to take you then, hopefully, if I do this well, on a little journey, modest journey. I'm not going to. So, first, imagine that you're working with clay. But you went to the store and you bought a dry powdered clay. So it's all the water's been taken out, just powder. And so you take this powdered clay. And you put it in a nice basin, and it's just powder, very soft, and you feel a soft texture of it, but it feels very dry. And then you take some water and start sprinkling some water into the dry clay. And then as the clay gets a little bit moist, you start kneading the clay until the clay starts hanging together, the dust kind of starts hanging together, and you have a moist clay. And you knead it really well so that the moisture, you don't want to have too much moisture so it starts dripping and oozing out, but just enough moisture so that it's well permeated, saturated, filled with pervading with moisture, right? So you're kind of doing it, kind of working it to pervade it. So that's the image. Now, imagine sometime in your life where you felt a degree of maybe kind of calm delight. Just really kind of delighted, but kind of in a calm way. Maybe a nice walk in the, up in the hills, and you had a nice lunch, and you kind of sat under a tree, and it was very nice. And you felt physically, you felt a certain kind of delight and joy in your body. And that joy and delight permeates and spreads and fills and pervades and saturates your whole body with a moisture of delight. Isn't that a nice image? And so this is the image, one image for concentration practice. And it has to do with your body. It has to do with taking, when concentration gets kind of strong, there's a feeling of delight that can happen, and that's very physical, and it can saturate and spread throughout your being, throughout your physical being. So that no part of your body is not touched by that delight. The image of moisture or water is one that's used a lot for concentration practice, and so maybe you can think of the Western symbolic ideas of water. I don't know if those were meant to be associated with this in the Buddhist teachings. But the idea of being dry versus the idea of being wet. If you're tense, then you're dry. And the more stress you have, the drier you are. And in fact, you kind of feel, kind of some parts of your dead body can kind of dead and numb if you really have a lot of tension and stress. And as the relaxation practice and letting go practice, concentration has a lot to do with letting go and relaxing. And as we let, so it's not just about focusing. I'm going to be one pointed here, you know, like a gun or whatever, laser. But rather, it has a lot to do with relaxing and softening and relaxing into a state. And as that happens, then at a relaxation state, then the body gets moist, moist with this delight. What do you think of that image? You like it? You ready for this? Ready for that? Okay. Now I'm going to give you a different image. And this is an image for mindfulness. You're a shepherd or a cow herder. And early in the season, when the crops were growing, it required a lot of attention to stay right close to the cows or the goats or whatever, make sure they didn't eat the neighbor's crops, you know, your crops, the wheat or the rice that's growing there, and make sure they only ate the weeds, and to kind of, you know, be very, very concerned and very kind of involved. But after the harvest, and there's all this stubble on the fields and, you know, everything's been harvested off the field, then you can just sit against a tree, and you still have to keep an eye on the cows or the goats, make sure they don't wander off too far, but you don't have to ride them so closely and make sure they don't eat what they're not supposed to eat. You can just let them kind of have free rein, and you can just be there relaxed and just watch and under the shade and just watch, you know, my cows and the goats. You're really, you're there and you're not falling asleep, but you're there. So being like a shepherd or a goat herder, a cow herder, who after the harvest, relaxed, at ease, up against the tree, but very, you know, kind of surveying, really seeing what's there, because, you know, the shepherd has to see what's there. You can't use your eyes. You can't just kind of sit and close your eyes and bask in some wonderful, you know, warm spring day. You have to be attentive. But the idea of mindfulness is this very relaxed, at ease attention that kind of is there, present for what's going on. Isn't that nice too? Are you ready for that? Go up against an oak tree someplace and just watch your cows. And so which of those two do you prefer? Do you rather be the wet clay, or would you rather be the goat herder up against the tree after the harvest? Which image is it most appealing to you? Are these foreign images? They don't work? No one's saying anything. No comment?
I'd rather be a wet goat herder.
Charlotte would rather be a wet goat herder. Good, that's great. Okay, so now another image for concentration. Imagine a wonderful kind of mountain, clear mountain lake. It's a very hot day, so the water is just refreshing, just very refreshing water. And there's no streams that run into this lake, and it doesn't rain hardly at all there. So the only place for this for the water to come in is from an underground spring that comes into that lake. And the underground, the temperature of that underground spring is just refreshing temperature, just really great temperature. Maybe it's been hot lately, so you can kind of imagine what it's like to kind of be in a wonderful, nice, refreshing lake. And that, that refreshing spring water comes up from the bottom of the lake and flows and moves like this wonderful current. It goes up and around and kind of moves out into the lake, fills the lake. You feel the kind of currents of this kind of wonderful, refreshing, you know, currents moving through you. So this is another image for certain states of concentration, that a certain kind of joy, a little bit different from delight, a certain kind of joy, happiness, can kind of welling up, again, in the body. So it's something you touch with your body, and it feels like it's kind of like some like currents moving through you, kind of feeling, upwelling feeling of delight, of energy, of refreshment. And it pervades, it fills, it saturates your whole body, so that no part of your body is not touched by that refreshing feeling of joy. What do you think of that? Is that a little bit better than being clay, lump of clay? Okay. And now, mindfulness. You've been involved in the hustle and bustle of life and traffic and all these things. And you manage to get away from it, and you go up on a nice, kind of nice, somewhat high hilltop. And from the hilltop, you look down upon the city and observe it all, and you feel yourself quite independent from the hustle and bustle and the busyness, all those people kind of driving their cars and honking at each other and running around and the rush hour traffic and wheeling and dealing and, you know, all the requirements of life and the social complexities, and you just kind of walk up there, and you kind of above it all, and above it all, in this wonderful hilltop, you have a great view. Not only do you see the busyness of life below, but you also see the vastness of the plains and the mountain ranges in the distance, and the ocean on one side, and you just have a great view. Kind of see it all, kind of great overview, and in that great overview of being not in the middle of congestion and traffic. You see kind of maybe the beauty and the specialness of life, but you really clearly feel like you're kind of a little bit independent and free from it all, but also seeing this great, beautiful panorama. So that's an image for mindfulness. When sometimes a mountaintop or a hilltop looking down, sometimes the Buddha used the image of being up in a high tower, above everything but looking down, having a bird's eye view. And one friend of mine uses the image of being an eagle. You know, high up, soaring high up is an eagle's view, an eagle's perspective. It can look down and see everything below. So that's an image for mindfulness. So which would you prefer to be? The upwelling spring in the lake? Or you'd rather kind of have this kind of independence of being up and above and just kind of great equanimity of kind of seeing out and seeing what's there? Yeah. You have a preference? Or you'd rather be a spring that's up on a high mountain. Yes.
Well, one is kind of essential sounding
spirit.
Who wouldn't want that?
Who wouldn't want that?
And then the other is distancing yourself. Sounding to me, because like distancing yourself. So if you, there's a lot of pain or difficult time, then the distancing might be easier.
Mm-hmm.
The other is definitely sounding like.
Yeah, sensual, yeah. Oh, nice. And the other one, it seems a little aloof, which maybe can feel aloof, can be kind of maybe unfriendly even a little bit if you're kind of removed from everything, but yes?
The first one has a connectedness.
First one has a sense of connectedness.
That appeals to me.
Uh-huh.
The other one, how do you, you're up there aloof and all that, but how do you stay connected?
Uh-huh. So So the first one seems connected, and the second one seems aloof. And how then do you stay connected? Mm-hmm. Good. Sometimes when there's concentration practice, people get very connected to themselves, but not necessarily. You know, they're like eyes are shut. It's very internal. At this point. Okay, so now another image for concentration. And so again, you know, the fact that it's been warm lately maybe helps with this, because in ancient India it was often hot, quite hot. I've been to the plains of northern India and this time of year, and boy, it's hot in May. And so again, the image has to do with water and has to do with a lake. And again, the water has a very refreshing temperature, very clear and beautiful water. And now, imagine that there's lotuses in this lake, blue and white and red lotuses, lotus flowers. But apparently, for some lotus flowers, they get born in the lake, in the water. They kind of come up out of the ground, I guess. And they grow and they grow and they develop, and even, I don't know if they even flower, but the whole lotus happens underwater. Some lotuses actually don't break the surface of the water. So because of that, the lotus plant is that underground, a submerged lotus, no part of the lotus is not touched. Again, the word touched is being used. No part of the lotus is not touched by the cool refreshment of that lake. Now, in this time, the lake, the water is quiet. It's still and calm. Remember the first time the lake, there was an upwelling current, which felt good, but it's also kind of active and kind of a thrill or something. And now the water is really peaceful and still. So it has this sense of peacefulness and quiet and calm. And no part of the lake, no part of the lotus is not touched by the refreshing but calm and still water. So sometimes in concentration practice, the sense of the thrill or the upwelling feeling of joy settles out, calms down, and it's replaced by a feeling of a well-being or happiness that feels quite, you know, calm or kind of more deeply satisfying than joy or delight. And then as the practice develops, one possibility is that it begins to pervade. And the Buddha uses all these words, pervade and fills and saturates the body, so that no part of the body is not touched by that happiness. So that's concentration. Now mindfulness. Mindfulness so imagine that you are in a kind of an ancient world, the old world. They often had cities that had, you know, fortifications, had walls around it, and they had a gate. And in order to get into the city, you had to go through the gate. And so they had a gatekeeper. And the gatekeeper would see who came and say, "Well, you know, I don't think you should be in this town. You know, you look like a marauding Hun. And we don't want Huns here. So not with their all their weapons and ready for looting. So you can't come. Thank you." Or see someone else says, "Oh, I know you. You can come in. You live here. So please come in." And some people come with messages for the king or the queen, and they say, this is the most direct route to find the royal chambers, and you can bring your message. And so the gatekeeper has this ability to stay there, notice what comes in and out, and then to make choices about what is allowed to come in and what has to stay out. So this is an analogy for being mindful, to have this ability to see and be present. Again, the gatekeeper sees what's there. Be present to see what's going on in our experience, to know what experiences take in and what experiences leave alone. But more importantly, to notice inside of ourselves what thoughts, what intentions, what urges are appropriate to act on, and what intentions, what impulses perhaps we just let go of. No, not now. So this ability to kind of be there at the gate, be there at kind of at the juncture between action, activity, and non-activity, and be able to decide how we're going to act. And at the most refined levels, it's not just simply acting with our body and our speech, but also how are we going to act with our thoughts, with our mind. Many people don't think of the mind as something that we have much choice over. But in fact, the mind is another, mental activity is just another activity that you can have choice over as you can with anything else. So, oh no, I'm not going to follow that train of thought. That's not useful. Or that particular inclination of feeling, I'll let go of that or something. So the ability to see and to make and to be a gatekeeper, to see what's there, to be at that interface between action and non-action and decide what you're going to do and what you're not going to do. So which do you prefer? Do you prefer to kind of just be kind of just resting in that wonderful lake, calm, peaceful, still, saturated and filled with, you know, none part of you is not touched with happiness? Or would you rather be a gatekeeper who is able to make wise choices? Your answer to this might have something to do with the kind of choices you've made lately. Some of you, you know, maybe have made such bad choices. Gee, you know, the pleasure thing was good, but, you know, I wish I'd been a gatekeeper back then. You know, but some of you maybe haven't made any bad choices lately, so you know, that's not really a, you know, you can't identify. So, okay, we have one more round of this these similes. So imagine that, again, it's really hot, 108 degree weather, or something, really hot weather, but there's a really clear, clean, refreshing lake, and you get to go in it and go for a delightful dip. And you go in there just long enough that you feel just refreshed and satisfied and just everything, you feel, you know, settled out and eased out. And then you go on shore and you wrap yourself in a soft cotton, white, clean, pure sheet. Soft and pure and clean, just maybe new or something. And you wrap yourself completely up in it, so no part of your body is not touched by the clean, white kind of sense of being contained or held by this nice sheet. So this is also an analogy for concentration practice, a deeper level of concentration than what we've talked about so far. Actually, each of these images I'm giving you of concentration practice represents deepening stages of concentration. And so now this deepest stage, it has this feeling of being completely cleansed and clean and refreshed by being in the pond. And then you kind of cover yourself, you're kind of enveloped in a nice, wonderful way of by this nice feeling of equanimity and peace and purity, sense of purity and equanimity. So no part of your body, just like when you cover yourself with this cloth, no part of your body is not touched by the cloth. So when you have this sense of equanimity, of peace, of serenity, where there's no more kind of strong happiness or strong joy, just a delightful sense of purity and equanimity, and a sense of mindfulness is there. No part of your body is not touched with that. That's the image for a deeper level of concentration. Okay? So please do that. Wrap yourself up nicely with your equanimity. Now, for mindfulness. Imagine that either you're a surgeon or you're someone who needs some kind of surgery. And so the surgeon she's going to do her job well, first comes with her hands and kind of begins probing a little bit in the area of the body where the surgery is going to happen. Kind of probing and testing, finding out what's there, really getting to studying it, kind of getting a feel for what's there, feeling like where the thing is, whatever needs to be done, or where the bones are and where the muscles are and where the cut needs to be, and kind of does this careful probing to find out, to gather information, to understand something, so that when the time comes to actually do the surgery, there's enough understanding of the geography of the body there that you can actually do a careful and good job. There's another part to this image, but, you know, so what would you rather have? A surgeon who just sits there wrapped very peacefully and calmly, you know, you know, or a surgeon who actually has the ability to actually get in there and touch and feel and probe and gather information and has, you know, years of experience to really know what is there and kind of sense. What would you prefer? Well, I'm sure you want a surgeon who really probes. So mindfulness has one function of mindfulness is to probe. To kind of put ourselves there, really feel and explore, really sense, to discover what's there, what's happening there, what's going on in our life. Really kind of offer kind of presence and mindfulness. What's really happening here? Whereas you sit there enveloped in a cloth, or, you know, you're not really finding anything out. It's nice, it's very satisfying, but you're not really learning anything. Similar to this, a little bit similar to this image of the probe, the surgeon probing, is that of a farmer plowing. In order to grow, conventional situations of farming, in order to grow a crop, you have to first plow the field. And you have to prepare the field. And once the field's been opened up and prepared, then you can sow the seeds. So mindfulness has a little bit like the plow that prepares the soil for something to grow, something to develop, something to happen. And so the mindfulness is the plow that creates the soil for the ground for wisdom to grow. So the mindfulness is there to kind of see what's there, kind of it's like the probe. You know, just putting your finger on someone is not going to teach you much, but you have to kind of use your wisdom, your understanding, and your discernment to understand and develop wisdom. So the same thing with mindfulness. Mindfulness kind of prepares the ground. If you're present and connected to your experience and seeing your experience carefully, then that prepares the ground for something to occur, and that's the arising of wisdom. And one of the functions of mindfulness practice is to create the conditions for the arising of wisdom. There is some wisdom that can come with concentration practice, but not a lot, and not enough to set a person free. So it can be very satisfying to be like a, you know, moist lump of clay, or a, you know, wonderful mountain lake, that kind of wonderful upwelling spring of water, and just feel so delightful and feel so unified and connected to yourself. It's just so great. Or it can be wonderful to be this calm lotuses in the calm lake, or, you know, all these images. But as wonderful as they are, and sometimes people will take them as being ultimate, and this is the great, I got it, this must be enlightenment. They are not the conditions or for the cultivation of deep wisdom that liberates a person, that frees a person. So these are two different practices. They're often understood as two different practices. And the Buddha taught both. So it isn't one, you know, the Buddha didn't say you have to choose between one or the other. Or, you know, it was very clearly recognized that the mindfulness practice is what brings the wisdom that leads to freedom. But that concentration practice also has a very honored and important place in the Buddha's teachings. So then the one interesting question is, how do they work together? And they can work together a variety of different ways. And they can work differently for different people. Some people will develop concentration practice first and develop these wonderful states that can happen. That's what they often need. Those wonderful states of unity and flowing joy and delight are very healing and provide a sense of well-being that can be very, very helpful and healing for people and create a kind of deep kind of sense of well-being that makes it easier to handle what mindfulness sees. So wisdom kind of is very, the kind of deep, wise seeing of mindfulness sometimes can be a little bit difficult for people. And so it helps a lot if you have a deep sense of well-being that allows you to see. So some people will cultivate concentration first. Some people will cultivate mindfulness first. And there's a good argument to be made that the Buddha taught that you would practice mindfulness first, a certain degree of mindfulness, until your mindfulness became established and strong enough that the mindfulness would help you move into these states of concentration. And then you could switch into concentration practices for a while. And so you can start with concentration first, then mindfulness, mindfulness first, then concentration. Or you can in some ways try to do them together, hold them together. So like two horses on pulling a wagon. They both work together. So you're developing both strong concentration and strong mindfulness simultaneously. And some of these deep states of well-being that can well up happen the same time as being able to continue to see very deeply what your experience is, what's happening here. So one has to do with more with touching, another more with seeing. I could imagine that there are people, because of their personal dispositions, will prefer one over the other. One seems so right, and the other seems so wrong. Or, you know, for whatever reasons, or, you know, to prefer one, you know, I don't want to be aloof, you know, or distant, you know, or up in the mountains. I want to be right there in the middle of it all and feeling the sensuality of it all. That's what I want. And in fact, people who are really sensual in nature, I think sometimes will have an easier time with concentration practice because it can be very sensual. It's very bodily. Unless you get too attached. Unless you're trying too much. If you get too attached, you can't do it. It has a lot to do with relaxing and letting go. And different people, you know, it's kind of like there's personality types and there are certain minds that gravitate more towards the mindfulness and other minds that gravitate more towards the concentration. And some people, you teach them mindfulness and they'll get concentrated. That's just what happens. Other people, you teach them concentration and they get mindful because that's what how their mind works. And some people are kind of in the middle. Most people are kind of in the middle and they can go either direction, whatever they're instructed to do, whatever the practice they're doing takes them. Part of the function of concentration is very important as a partner to mindfulness. Because in order for mindfulness to do the deep work that leads to liberation, it needs to be coupled with the ability to be very concentrated, to be very focused, very centered, to be able to be that probe that really gets in there. That surgeon has to be very concentrated to really get all the information that's there. And so cultivating some concentration is very, very helpful for mindfulness. In the classic system that we have at Spirit Rock, the idea is that concentration is supposed to be developed simultaneously together with mindfulness. And that works relatively well. And there are other schools of practice where concentration practice is developed first, and then a person switches to mindfulness practice once the concentration is strong enough. Then one more, I'd like to give another analogy that the Buddha taught, and that has to do with acrobats. These two acrobats and the acrobat's assistant or apprentice were going to do some acrobatic tricks, and the acrobat said to the assistant, the assistant's going to climb up on my shoulders and, you know, stand on your hands and I'll hold you up. You know, we'll do these tricks, you know, on each other. And the acrobat says to the assistant, watch carefully over me, and then we won't have any problems. Just, you know. And the assistant says, no. You watch carefully over yourself, and I'll watch carefully over myself, and therefore we won't have any problems. So they had this little disagreement. So they went to the Buddha, and the Buddha said, or the Buddha used this as an analogy and said, that's right. If you watch over yourself and watch your own balance and everything, then you know you can just keep your balance and do what's right, and the other person that's responsible for their balance, and you can find your way together just right. So in the same way, when practicing mindfulness, it's very important to be mindful over oneself and find one's own balance, and then having our own balance, then we can help other people. But if we don't have our own balance first, then it's dangerous to try to help other people. Then you both might fall if you're acrobats. So the idea of both of being mindful for yourself is not just simply something that's supposed to be selfish, but creates, again, the conditions, the soil, the ground for being able to be helpful towards others, which is a very important element in the Buddhist tradition, is also to be helpful. And how helpful can you be? The most helpful you can be, and here's another analogy. If you, this is a dirty, slimy, quicksand analogy of water, right? If you and a friend get caught in quicksand and need to get out of the quicksand, you know, and it's kind of quicksand, every time you push down, you know, to get some leverage to get put up, you just can sink deeper down, right? So he said, I'll help you then. So you take your friend and you're going to pull your friend out. But then you only sink in deeper. And then your friend says, wait, I'll help you. And he pulls in. Your friend sinks deeper, right? You kind of drown together that way. It doesn't work. What you need to do is one of you needs to get up on dry land. And then from dry land, you can reach your hand in and help pull the other person up. So how is it that we can be most helpful? And the most helpful is to somehow get ourselves on dry land, get safe, get free. And then from that place of freedom, then we can offer the most help for someone else. And so The goal in Buddhism, in classic Buddhism, is to become free, is to become liberated. And in becoming liberated, then being able to offer that to someone else. And if you try to help other people first, then there is a danger, the quicksand danger of two people who are both in quicksand, they're going to sink. So the ultimate, you know, so mindfulness is the practice that leads to liberation, but it's helpful if you couple it with concentration practice to develop a sense of well-being, develop this healing, develop a sense of connectedness. But don't confuse the unity experience, the oneness experience of concentration as being the end of the road. Don't settle for that. But at some point, also be willing to look more carefully. Be relaxed in looking, be like a cowherder, you know, be very relaxed. It's, for people practicing mindfulness, it's a huge training to learn how to be relaxed and at ease in looking at what we're looking at. And also develop some sense of independence as we look. We're not caught by what's there, but we're independent, we're free from what we look at. We're looking, we're really there, but we're free from, like we're up in a tower looking down, we're not caught in everything. And then use your mindfulness to probe carefully, to look carefully. Oh, you be like a gatekeeper who decides what to act on and what not to act on. And act in such ways that supports your spiritual life. And then be like a probe, you know, that looks more deeply, or like a plow that creates a condition for the rising of wisdom and freedom. And if you do that work, create the soil and allow the rising of wisdom, and it gets time for liberation, then the instructions goes back to the same kind of language as is used for concentration practice. Touch liberation. Liberation is something you touch. So again, it's not something again, the idea of being removed and separate is not quite the image for liberation. You have to touch liberation, or more dramatically, plunge into it. Dive into it. Like you would lake with a concentration practice. You dive into that cool lake. So that's the image the Buddha had. So, does that answer the question of the difference between mindfulness and concentration? A little bit, in a different way. So, may both wings be a support to you. May you both plunge into those wonderful pools. And may you be dry on the dry gatekeeper, or the goat herder. So, or the wet goat herder. So thank you very much.